All right, how to influence friends and tactfully get along with people. We're in a management course. Management is all about leading on the one hand, but helping people reach the goals of an organization on the other. And so you have to get along with people on the one hand, but you need to be helping them go forward. We looked in part one of Paul's letter, the first few verses. We're talking, Paul, his main goal was building some rapport with Philemon. He has a difficult thing to deal with, but he wants to start with the relationship. You know, we're friends, we're on the same team, we both need God's grace, neither one of us is perfect. There's some of the things I appreciate about you, there's positive things I've heard about you. All the things that Paul says are about building the relationship. Well, part two, Paul sort of moves very gently into taking the relationship that has been built and now using that to influence. So Paul is going to use what he has built, use the relationship to sort of go a little bit forward. So now he's starting to talk about the issue, but he's doing it in a very gentle way. He's building on what he's done and moving towards his goal. So, how do you do that? Well, you start out by appealing to a higher motive. That's what he does in verses 8 through 9a. Therefore, he says, although in Christ I could be bold and order you to do what you ought to do, yet I prefer to appeal to you on the basis of love. So, Paul starts out, I could order you to do what you should do. And that is one way to influence someone. That is one way to manage. And it works fast. You want something done? You want to get somewhere? You want someone to move in a certain direction? Just tell them what to do. Bosses like to do this. Coaches like to do this. Parents love to do this. Here, just do this. It's very clear. I'm telling you exactly what it is that I want you to do. Go clean your room. Do this report. Have it on my desk by Monday. So force as a motivating tool. It works fast. It's very clear. But number three, you must have the authority, to order someone. And the power, boldness to do it. If you don't have authority over someone, you can't just tell them what to do. They can just not listen to you. And you may have the authority to tell someone what to do, but if you don't have the power, so maybe in an organization there's someone that's sort of under you and you're trying to lead that person, you're trying to help them do something for the organization, and you tell him that he must do that, but if you have no power over him, you can't fire him, you can't reprimand him, there's nothing you can really do, then he doesn't have to listen to you. Force as a motivating tool, you must be present. Number four, you must be present. You have to force, the enforcer has to always be there. If you're not there, there's a saying, if the cat's away, the mice will play, because the force is not there. Number five, it must be constant. If you're going to motivate people by force, by just simply telling them what to do, people are going to wait to be told what to do. They're not going to think ahead. They're not going to use their own minds to figure out what it is. They're just going to sit around and wait. And that's a trap that parents often fall into. They tell their kids what to do, and it works fast, it's quick, it's easy. But now the kids have been sort of mentored in that, and they sit around waiting. They don't just go clean their room on their own. They don't do it one day, say, I think the garage is a little dirty. I think I'll clean that up for Dad. No. They got used to being told what to do, and that's what they'll do, only what they are told. When what you really want is a team player, someone who sees the problems and acts. Someone you don't have to be on their backs pushing them and shoving them to get them to do what they should do. So Paul says, I could do this. I have the authority. Maybe I have the power even. But I don't want to do that. Guilt is another motivating tool. If you don't have the authority and you don't have the power, then guilt is something, you know, I'm just going to make you feel guilty. Parents often will do this. You know, after everything I've done for you, the least that you could do for me is to clean up your room or to take care of this. Bosses will do that. I pay your insurance. I give you a good wage. I give you something to do. And then, how do you treat me? How do you, you know, what's your response to everything I've done for you? Pastors and church leaders will use this same motivation. After everything that God has done for you, He sent His Son to die on a cross for you, and you can't even show up for church on Sunday for 1 hour. I mean, I've used that on people. But the problem with guilt is it works, and it works fast, but it, number two, has diminishing returns. People get used to that feeling, and they don't respond anymore. And number three, guilt turns into something. The problem with guilt is you put some guilt onto somebody, and it doesn't stay guilt very long. People feel bad at first, but then they generally take the guilt they're feeling and they turn it into anger. And the anger goes two different directions. The one direction is out, anger out. So you come and you make me feel guilty about something that I should have done after everything you've done for me. My dad used to do that. You know, he'd give a whole list of everything that he's done for us, and we can't even clean the garage because, you know, we saw it's dirty and we didn't do anything. And he'd lay the guilt on us. And then he would go on and on and on and on, and we'd start feeling like, well, this is unfair. We very quickly would take the guilt that we were feeling and turn it into anger, and anger out means I'm angry at you. I get angry at whoever is putting the guilt on me. And that's what often happens. You can go with the people you're trying to manage and you're trying to lead. You can try to make them feel guilty, and they feel guilty for a little bit. But then when they get to the back room and they talk among themselves, they start saying, well, who does he think? He didn't even notice what I had done. And on and on and on. And they start getting angry at the person who made them feel guilty. So it boomerangs back at you. Or sometimes people will take the guilt they feel and they'll turn it into anger on themselves. Yeah, you know, I am guilty. I am so worthless. You know, I always do this. I fail at everything that I do. And they just take the anger and they turn it in themselves. And anger in is depression. So instead of motivating someone to go out and do something, all you do is make a person that's either angry back at you, or they turn it into anger at themselves. So Paul, instead, he doesn't use the power. He doesn't command Philemon what to do. He doesn't guilt Philemon, but he appeals to a higher cause. Well, what does that do? What is appealing to what even is that? Appealing to a higher cause. Paul says, I want you to do something out of love, not because you have to, and not because I tell you what to do, but because you want to be a loving, caring person. It's a bigger thing. It encompasses more than what we're just talking about. It's the kind of thing that, you know, a soldier joins an army and he fights for a country. But in reality, he doesn't fight for the whole country. He fights for the group of people that he gets to know. He's willing to die for his friends. And the group of friends is a bigger cause than just himself. People are looking for a bigger cause, or people will work really, really hard for a team that they've joined. They wouldn't work that hard for anything else. But because they're on this team, they'll put in the practices and the time. People will work for a company when they feel like that company is actually doing something that may change the world. Or the church, you know, when you're involved in a church and you really feel like, hey, what we're doing could really put a dent in the devil's kingdom and propel God's kingdom forward. It's something bigger than what I'm doing, something bigger than what you're doing. And the commitment, number one, actually grows as the project grows. If you appeal to a higher cause, hey, we're trying to do something important here, and people get on board, the commitment to it grows. We did a renovation in our church, and it was hard at first, and people don't see the vision, and they don't see what it could be. But as it went along, more and people are, and you know, at the end, everyone wants to volunteer, and everyone wants to do something. Number two, it's self-sustaining. You don't have to keep commanding people. You don't have to keep telling people what to do. You don't have to keep, you know, laying down a fresh layer of guilt. When you appeal to a higher cause and people start contributing to this higher cause, they catch on and they get motivated in and of themselves and they start motivating other people. So number three, it generates enthusiasm. The team gets excited about what it's doing. All right, so that's the first one of part two. Use it to influence. Number two is communicate your own needs in the language of the other's needs. And this is kind of a complicated one, but listen to this. Philemon 1, 9b through 10. It is none other than Paul. Okay, Paul is writing this. He says, it is none other than Paul, an old man, and now also a prisoner of Christ Jesus, that I appeal to you for my son Onesimus, who has become my son while I was in chains. Okay, so Paul, you know, Onesimus has been returned to Philemon as a prisoner. So he comes back, he had escaped, but he comes back, he's now a prisoner. What to do with Onesimus the prisoner? That's the question. Paul here speaks of himself to Philemon as one who is a prisoner as well, in a negative and positive way. Negatively, he's a prisoner of the Romans, but positively, Paul is a prisoner of Jesus Christ. So Paul, in a sense, speaks about the issue, the problem that they need to deal with, but he uses the language of Philemon, the language that Philemon is immersed into here. Well, why is it important to speak to someone you're trying to influence in the language of their own interests and concerns? Philippians 2, Paul wrote to that church in Philippi, do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of others. If you go into a conflict situation, and as you talk, the person that you're talking to has the sense that all you care about is your own situation, your own language, what you lack or don't lack, what you're going to get or what you're not going to get, how the whole thing affects you. If you constantly talk about this situation from your own perspective, then that person will get that sense that all you care about is you and that you don't care about the other person and you don't care about where they're coming from. But if you take the time to try to see things from their point of view and actually speak to them from their point of view, if they're hurting, you speak about hurt. If they're into something, you speak, you know, if they use a metaphor, you know, switch metaphors. If they start talking to you about, you know, how they feel, and they feel like a maid, and, you know, all I do is, you know, pick up after you and so on. Well, don't switch the metaphor and start talking about sports because you happen to be into sports, because that says you didn't hear a thing about what they said about being a maid. If you're going to respond, you respond using the same metaphor, stay in the same genre to say that you're actually listening to them. Well, how do you speak to someone you're trying to influence in the language of their own interests and concerns? Learn their appreciation language. I mentioned this before. Some people feel appreciated when you give them words. They're word people. They need to hear, I appreciate you. You know, what you did for me made a big difference. They need to hear those words. Other people, they are more sort of, they have the language of gifts. When they want to communicate that they care about somebody, they buy a little gift. If you want to communicate that you appreciate them, you have to speak in their language. You have to buy a little gift. For some people, I think I mentioned myself as an example, my appreciation language is challenge. If you appreciate me, then you will challenge me, or you'll give me a challenge. Hey, we'd like you to be responsible for this because we notice that you do well with these kinds of things. That tells me that you appreciate me. So when you're dealing with people, learn their appreciation language. Next, learn their hobbies. What are they into? Are they into quilting? Are they into stamp collecting? Are they into sports? If they're into these things, talk about these things. Use the language of sports as your metaphor if they're into that. Learn their trade language. What are they into? What industry are they into? And if you're going to use analogies and metaphors again, then pick something from something that they're into. And what does that do? It just tells them that you are trying to figure this whole problem, this conflict, this thing you want to deal with, you're trying to figure it out from their point of view. And you're listening and you're open to their view. You're not just stuck on your own.